This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Para Tolson. This program's designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
And this is Bob Martin, and I'm getting a little worried.
And why is that?
Well, I haven't heard from George yet.
It's now George instead of King George.
You ought to hear what some of the early colonists called him.
Never mind.
Anyway, why did you expect to hear from him?
To tell me what thing of importance happened on August 10th.
You mean this is still all about your birthday?
I'm still saving a piece of the birthday cake.
No ice cream?
Well, it kind of melted.
Well, maybe he can't comment until we look at the rest of August. Right, Kurt?
Good idea, Para. But before we go on to August 20th, I'd like to return to an event of August 19th, Horace Greeley's open letter to President Lincoln regarding slavery. It was entitled Prayer of 20 Millions. The letter called upon the president to exercise all of his authority to further the cause of emancipation. There is some disagreement about the date of the letter, as some sources say it should be dated on August 20th, Lincoln's reply cites the 19th, and we spoke of that event along with other happenings on the 19th. And on the 22nd, you will hear Lincoln's response.
But on August 20th, 1866, President Andrew Johnson declared the war ended.
And now on to other events of August 20th. A dispatcher at the New York Times office wanted to know how long it would take to send a telegram around the world.
Nobody had ever done it before?
This was 1911. So on August 20th at 7 p.m., a dispatch was sent from the 17th floor of the Times building in New York.
Well, what did the message say?
This message sent around the world.
I know the message was sent around the world, but what did the message say?
That was the message. It said, quote, "This message sent around the world."
Well, that seems redundant.
Not until it actually made it around the world.
So, what happened?
The message was relayed via 16 different operators. It went through San Francisco, the Philippines, Hong Kong, Saigon, Singapore, Bombay, Malta, Lisbon, the Azores, and several other locations.
Did it make it?
Yes, it did. It arrived back to the same operator that had sent it from the 17th floor of the New York Times building.
And how long did it take?
6.5 minutes.
And when he got it, what did the message say?
Moving ahead. On August 20th, 1977, NASA launched Voyager 2, an unmanned spacecraft from Cape Canaveral, Florida. It was the first of two rockets launched that year. Voyager 1 set off 2 weeks later.
Voyager 2 left before Voyager 1?
Voyager 1 was faster, and it caught up.
Each Voyager carried a gold-plated visual disc carrying greetings in different languages, scientific information about the human race, nature sounds, messages from President Jimmy Carter and Secretary General Kurt Waldheim, and music.
Did you know that some of the music sent included Mozart, Vaya Balkanska, Blind Willie Johnson, and Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Good?
More importantly, the two Voyagers were designed to explore the outer solar system and send back pictures to Earth. Both ships passed by Jupiter and Saturn, and then Voyager 1 headed for outer space. Voyager 2 passed by Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto before following her sister ship.
During the ensuing years, the two Voyagers have sent back a wealth of information. Photographs of Saturn's rings, active geysers and volcanoes on some of the planet's moons, and 1,500-mile-per-hour winds on Neptune. As of November 2012, both Voyagers are still communicating with Earth.
Has anyone called home yet?
Do you mean phoned home? Bob. On August 20th, 1794, the Battle of Fallen Timbers took place near present-day Toledo. Here is the background. The Ohio River boundary line established with Britain from the Treaty of Fort Stanwix in 1768 recognized certain lands as belonging to the Native American nations. After the American Revolution, however, the United States maintained that the Indian nations no longer owned the lands in the Ohio area, citing an article in the Treaty of Paris of 1783, in which Britain agreed to cede the lands owned by indigenous nations.
Native Americans rejected the notion that the British or Americans could dispose of their tribal lands without their consent. They said they did not have a representative at the treaty negotiations, did not sign the treaty, and did not recognize as giving away rights to their lands. As American settlers began moving into the Ohio Territory in increasing numbers, the Indians viewed them as unwanted intruders. The United States government insisted that it had the right to seize the lands, which had been conquered and battled and agreed to by the Treaty of Paris.
As more skirmishes between settlers and the Native Americans broke out, in 1794, President Washington sent Mad Anthony Wayne to combat the Federation led by Shawnee chiefs Blue Jacket and Wakankahalas.
The Indians were outnumbered 3,000 to 1,500 and were defeated in what was to be the last battle of the Northwest Indian Wars. The territory eventually became Ohio and Indiana.
On August 20, 1995, a collision between two trains in northern India killed 358 people. It was the worst train disaster in India's history. There were two factors involved in the tragedy. One concerned the railway system, and the other concerned a cow.
First, the railway system. Train travel in India is very inexpensive. People can travel for hundreds of miles for just a few dollars. This means that unreserved coaches are always crowded, and since trains are tightly scheduled, safety procedures are not always followed.
Now comes the cows. Cows hold a special place in the Hindu religion and are allowed to roam freely anywhere in India. Thus, the potential of problems as occurred on August 20th of 1995.
A cow wandered across the train tracks and was hit by a train headed for New Delhi. None of the 900 passengers were injured, but the brakes on the train were damaged, and the train could not continue on its journey, so the train sat.
Now along comes another train with 1,300 people on board on the same tracks, and the signalman fails to signal the oncoming locomotive to stop.
And so, it doesn't.
Full speed in the first train. Six cars on each train virtually exploded.
Besides the 358 people who were killed, there were another 400 who were seriously injured.
And the signalman, who failed to stop the oncoming train, left the scene and was never found.
Did you know that following that disaster, no major changes were made to the rail system?
On August 20th of 2004, the city of Wenatchee set a record with its tow truck parade. 83 tow trucks rolled through streets of Wenatchee in single file.
Did you know that the Guinness Book of World Records claims that that parade, held in Wenatchee, Washington, is the longest parade of tow trucks ever?
The claim is made that the tow trucks came into existence in Chattanooga, Tennessee, when Ernest Holmes hooked a system of three poles, a pulley, and a chain, all connected to the frame of a 1913 Cadillac. Holmes had found a way to help a friend retrieve a Model T Ford that had slid into a creek.
The main goal was to improve the image of tow trucks. Many people don't like tow trucks, especially if they come back to that empty space where their car had been illegally parked. This was a chance to see tow trucks from their better side.
Did you know that I was there that day?
You were part of the parade?
No, I wasn't officially a part of the parade. My car had broken down, and we were number 84 on the way to the garage.
On August 20th, 1932, in Flanders, Belgium, Kathy Kulwitz unveiled a monument to her son Peter. In 1914, the boy enlisted in the German army and was killed on October 22nd, 1914.
The tragedy affected her art, and over the following years, she created works entitled Widows and Orphans, Killed in Action, and The Survivors. The monument to her son was entitled The Parents and showed an elderly couple kneeling at the grave of their son.
In later years, Hitler would condemn her political views and declared her works to be degenerate. Her grandson, also named Peter, was killed in 1942 at the Russian front.
In her final years, she said, "In days to come, people will hardly understand this age. What a difference between now and 1914. people have been transformed so that they have this capacity for endurance. Worst of all is that every war already carries the war which will answer it. Every war is answered by a new war until everything, everything is smashed. She died on April 22, 1945, just 2 weeks before World War II ended, and she wrote in her final letter, "War accompanies me to the end."
In February of 1831, there was a solar eclipse, and Nat Turner took it as a sign from God to lead his people out of slavery. On August 21st, he launched a slave revolt in Southampton County, Virginia. He planned to capture a county armory and then head for the dismal swamp where he could elude any pursuers.
Turner had killed his slave master, Joseph Travis, and Travis's family. Then, over the next 2 weeks, he gathered followers, an estimated 75 in number, and began a rampage across the county, killing about 60 whites. The state militia was called out to crush the rebellion.
The militia caught up with Turner and his followers, and the rebellion was quashed within 2 days. Some 54 of the band were killed during the fighting or executed afterwards. But in the aftermath, some 200 more blacks were killed, though most of them may have had nothing to do with the rebellion.
Turner himself escaped the initial capture and was not apprehended until the end of October. He was tried and hung on November 11th. Turner's slave rebellion was the largest slave revolt in U.S. history and brought about a wave of restrictive legislation which repressed the right of assembly and of education regardless of whether they were slave or free.
Did you know that one of the repressive measures was a law that required a white clergyman to be present at all black religious services?
On August 21st, 1959, Hawaii became the 50th state. The first known settlers of the islands were Polynesian voyagers who arrived sometime in the 8th century. They were pretty much left alone in the islands until the 18th century when traders arrived to exploit the sandalwood that grew there. And then in the 19th century, the sugar industry came, and the islands were commercially established.
By the middle of the 19th century, missionaries joined the planters, and westernization continued, which stripped the Hawaiian monarch of much of his authority. Then in 1893, a group of American businessmen, with a little help from a division of Marines, deposed Queen Liliuokalani.
Did you know that a report from 1894 claimed that the overthrow was locally motivated because of years of abuse by the monarchy, and the Marines were there only to protect American property?
A year later, Hawaii was established as a U.S. protectorate, with Sanford Dole as its president. Many in Congress were opposed to formal annexation, and it wasn't until after Pearl Harbor was used as a military base during the Spanish-American War that the U.S. realized the strategic importance of Hawaii.
In 1891, Hawaii was organized into a formal U.S. territory, and during World War II, the islands became firmly embedded in the U.S. consciousness following the attack on Pearl Harbor. Then came the appeal for statehood, and in March of 1959, the U.S. government approved statehood for Hawaii.
In June, the people of Hawaii voted approval by a wide margin, and on August 21, 1959, a proclamation was signed making Hawaii the 50th state.
On August 21st of 1863, raiders massacred the residents of Lawrence, Kansas. The problem in the area goes back to 1854, when the Kansas-Missouri border became a battleground over the issue of slavery.
Feelings ran pretty high between those who objected to slavery and those who thought that it was perfectly all right.
As it did here. While the residents of Kansas were debating the issue, bands of slave advocates from Missouri, a slave state, were crossing the border into Kansas and attacking abolitionist settlements. One such group was led by notorious William Quantrill.
The Kansans reacted, and a Union detachment under the command of Thomas Ewing arrested some of the wives and sisters of the gang. Unfortunately, on August 14th, the roof of the compound where some of the women were being held collapsed, and four of the women were killed.
Quantrill, who was already planning an attack on Lawrence, used this as added incentive. With an army of 450 men on August 21st, 1863, he rode into Lawrence, Kansas, an abolitionist stronghold, burnt the town, and killed all the men and boys in sight.
Did you know that some of the members of that gang were the Younger Brothers and Frank and Jesse James?
From that gang, Frank James figures into another event occurring on August 21st. His trial began on that day in Gatlin, Missouri. Frank had robbed a lot of banks and had killed many men while a rider with Quantrill. But he became discouraged after his brother Jesse was shot in the back in the spring of 1882.
He figured it was just a matter of time before the same thing happened to him by someone looking for the reward money. He figured he had a better chance with the courts. So he surrendered himself in October of 1882.
Frank's trial began April 23, 1883, and went even better than expected. In spite of his past history, most people in Missouri saw him as kind of a hero who stole from crooked banks and businessmen. The defense pictured him as a defender of the South against corrupt businesses from the North.
One character witness was General Joseph Shelby, who, when he was asked to identify Frank James, said,
"Where is my old friend and comrade in arms? Ah, I see him. Allow me. I wish to shake hands with a fellow soldier who fought by my side for Southern rights."
The rural people of Missouri refused to convict Frank James. Twice more in the courts of Missouri and Alabama, juries returned verdicts of not guilty. In late 1883, Frank James was a free man.
Did you know that after his trials, the only shots that he fired came from a gun that he used at horse races when he worked as a starter at county racetracks?
In Paris, on August 21st, 1911, the theft of the Mona Lisa was discovered. An amateur painter had walked into the Louvre, set up his easel in front of the Mona Lisa, and started to sketch. When he looked up, the painting was missing.
Who was responsible? Was it professional thieves? Not likely. Who was still the most famous painting in the world? And who would buy it? Perhaps it was the Germans trying to embarrass the French?
It was 2 years later before the truth was known. A former employee, Vincenzo Perugia, simply removed the picture from its frame, put it under his coat, and walked out. Why? He said it was his patriotic duty to right the wrong that had been done by Napoleon and return the work to its rightful home in Italy.
In November of 1913, he attempted to ransom the painting but was caught. The painting was returned to France and is now back hanging in the Louvre.
Maybe Perugia did it because he thought he had nothing to lose, and he was captured when he discovered that he didn't have the Monet to buy Degas to make the Van Gogh.
Bob, I didn't think you had Chagall to say something like that. On this day in 2004, Michael Phelps won his 8th Olympic medal. He had gone to Athens with the intent of breaking Mark Spitz's record of 7 gold, but came up short, winning 6 gold and 2 bronze.
He didn't beat Spitz's record in Athens, but he did do 4 years later in Beijing. And then in 2012 in London, he won 6 more. He became the most decorated athlete in modern Olympic history. He has 22 medals, 18 of them gold.
On August 21st, 1935, the swing era began when Benny Goodman and his orchestra opened at the Paloma Ballroom in Los Angeles. Remember tuxedo-clad band members, the Jitterbug, the Lindy Hop, and other bands like the Dorsey Brothers, Harry James, and Tex Beneke? It all started with Benny.
On this date in 1858, the Lincoln-Douglas debates began. The office that was at stake? Douglas' Senate seat. Lincoln lost that election, but it brought him into the national prominence.
And on this day in 1920, Daphne Milne gave birth to a son. She was the wife of author A.A. Milne, and they named the boy Christopher. Did you know he became the Christopher Robin of the Winnie the Pooh stories?
The first event of August 22nd is President Lincoln's response to Horace Greeley's Prayer of 20 Millions.
What may seem curious to us was that President answered personally, not as is done so much presently through a press release. This was Lincoln's response to an appeal to quicken the freeing of the slaves, especially as Greeley believed that such an act would weaken the Confederacy in its cause.
Honorable Horace Greeley, Dear Sir, I have just read yours of the 19th, addressed to myself through the New York Tribune. If there be in it any statements or assumptions of fact, which I may know to be erroneous, I do not now and here controvert them. If there be perceptible in it an impatient and dictatorial tone, I waive it in deference to an old friend whose heart I have always supposed to be right. As to the policy I seem to be pursuing, as you say, I have not meant to leave anyone in doubt. I would save the Union. I would save it the shortest way under the Constitution. The sooner the national authority can be restored, the nearer the Union will be the Union it was. If there be those who would not save the Union, unless they could at the same time save slavery, I do not agree with them. If there be those who would not save the Union, unless they could at the same time destroy slavery, I do not agree with them. My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union. It is not either to save or to destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving some others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union. And what I forbear because I don't believe it would help save the Union. I shall do less whenever I shall believe what I am doing hurts the cause, and I shall do more whenever I shall believe doing more will help the cause. I shall try to correct errors when shown to be error. I shall adopt new views so fast as they shall appear to be true views. I have here stated my purpose according to my view of official duty, and I intend no modification of my oft-expressed personal wish that all men everywhere could be free. Yours, A. Lincoln.
Greeley did not know that Lincoln did have in mind an edict of emancipation. And when the Emancipation Proclamation came 6 months later in January of 1863, it came from Lincoln's conscience, not as a result of editorial pressure.
On August 22, 1992, Hurricane Andrew hit the Bahamas. 2 days later, it hit the southern Florida coast. The storm was responsible for the deaths of 26 people, and it caused $35 million in property damage.
Andrew first formed in the eastern Atlantic on the 15th near Cape Verde, an island country about 350 miles off the western coast of Africa. It moved west, attaining hurricane force about 800 miles east of Miami. It was a Category 4 storm by the time it hit the Bahamas on the 22nd.
By the time it came ashore at Florida City, it had winds of 140 miles per hour with gusts up to 212. In Kendall and Homestead, Andrew uprooted every tree and destroyed 90% of the homes.
The Homestead Air Base was demolished, and Dade County lost electricity. There were reports of trucks being tossed up in the air and steel beams being thrown over 100 feet. A 210-ton freighter lost its anchor and was carried over the entire landmass of Elliott Key.
It took only 4 hours for Andrew to clear Florida, but in all, 25,000 homes, 8,000 businesses, and 15,000 boats were lost.
Andrew next headed across the Gulf of Mexico, but by the time it reached Louisiana, it lost much of its strength and was downgraded to a tropical storm.
On August 22, 1922, Michael Collins was assassinated. In the early part of the century, Collins had joined Sinn Féin, an Irish political party dedicated to achieving a free Ireland.
In 1911, the British Liberal government approved negotiations meant to attain Irish Home Rule. Opposition to the plan came from British conservatives and from anti-Home Rule advocates in Ireland. The plan was defeated.
In 1918, with the threat of conscription being imposed by Britain on the Irish people, Sinn Féin won a majority in the national elections and established an independent Irish parliament.
Did you know that in 1919, Michael Collins led an effective guerrilla campaign against the British forces?
2 years later, a ceasefire was declared, and Michael Collins was one of the architects of the peace treaty, which granted autonomy to Southern Ireland. Then in 1922, Arthur Griffith, the founder of Sinn Féin, was elected president of the newly established Irish Free State, with Michael Collins being appointed the finance minister.
But on August 22nd of 1922, Michael Collins was killed in an ambush by Republican extremists.
A horse, my kingdom for a horse. That is the famous line from Shakespeare's play Richard III. But it does have a firm place in history. On August 22nd, 1485, Richard III was killed in battle by Henry Tudor. This battle on Bosworth Field was part of the War of the Roses.
During the 1450s, English failures during the 100 Years' War with France, coupled with fits of insanity suffered by King Henry VI, led to a power struggle between two royal families, the House of Lancaster, symbolized by a red rose, and the House of York, symbolized by a white rose.
The War of the Roses had severely decreased the ranks of the nobility in England. Some of the royal casualties were Richard of York, Richard Neville, the Duke of Warwick, and two kings, Henry VI and Richard III.
The Battle of Bosworth Field and the death of Richard III brought an end to the royal struggle, and the two houses were reunited in 1486. With the marriage of Henry VII and Elizabeth, daughter of Edward IV.
Did you know that the reign of the Tudor dynasty that began with Henry VII would last for over a century and didn't end until the death of Queen Elizabeth I in 1603?
On this date in 1851, the America Cup was born. Now, yacht racing may not seem much like a spectator sport, but this one race, the America Cup, seems to capture the sailing world's attention.
The first race was held in 1851, and it involved a course that went around the Isle of Wight. It was won by the U.S. ship America, which defeated the British ship Aurora.
In 1864, an international committee of nations at Geneva met to discuss the issue of amelioration of the condition of the wounded and sick of armies on the battlefield. There were 12 nations present.
On August 22nd, the recommendation was passed that a neutral force be established that could care for battlefield casualties. They were to be allowed to function without fear of attack by either side, and they would operate under the symbol of a red cross on a white field.
Did you know that that is the reverse of the Swiss national flag, which is a white cross on a red field?
On August 22nd, 1935, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Annie Proulx was born in Norwich, Connecticut. She lived in several different towns in New England and North Carolina. Once, when she was homesick with the chicken pox, she wrote her first story when she was 10 years old.
Her first collection of stories was published in 1988, and her first novel, Postcards, in 1992, won a Penn Faulkner Award. And then her second novel, Shipping News, won the Pulitzer Award. The Shipping News, she uses sailor's knots as a tie-in for the chapters, and those knots came from Ashley's work, Book of Knots.
Did you know that Annie Proulx also wrote a short story that became the controversial film, Brokeback Mountain?
On this date in 1993, there was a deadly shooting at a police standoff at Ruby Ridge, Idaho. Randy Weaver, a purported white supremacist, had been targeted by the FBI for selling an illegal sawed-off shotgun to federal agents. On the first day of the standoff, Weaver's 14-year-old son was shot in the back and killed.
Then, on August 22nd, a federal agent wounded Weaver and Kevin Harris and fired through a door, killing Weaver's wife. In the aftermath, a wrongful death lawsuit was filed against the federal government, and Weaver received a settlement of $100,000. Each of his two daughters was awarded $1 million each.
Jim Mullen, during his 47 years, had worked as a deputy sheriff and a city marshal. He had also been a gambler, a swindler, and one of the deadliest professional killers in Texas. On August 22nd of 1898, this former assassin was ready for his next job. He became a Texas Ranger.
In 1938, on August 22nd, Frederick Austerlitz and Virginia Catherine McNath graced the cover of Life magazine.
They are better known as Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers.
And did you know they met on the set of Astaire's first movie, Flying Down to Rio? They were a natural dancing pair.
Remember the song, Born on a Mountaintop in Tennessee, which claimed the birthplace of frontiersman Davy Crockett? Well, this day in 1784 answers the question of what state he was actually born in. On this day, four counties seceded from North Carolina and established themselves as a separate territory.
The previous April, North Carolina had ceded the area to the federal government, but settlers began to worry that the Federals would sell off the land to some foreign power in order to pay off some of its war debt. So, in 1784, North Carolina rescinded their offer and reclaimed the territory.
It was at this point that the settlers declared their independence and applied for separate statehood under the name of Frankland. Congress approved the request by a simple majority, but not by the two-thirds vote needed for it to become an actuality. So, they changed their name to simply the State of Franklin, hoping to garner Benjamin Franklin's support. Still, no acceptance.
During the next 4 to 5 years, Franklin may have had its own constitution and its own legislature, but what it didn't have was a military for protection. So when the settlements began to be attacked by surrounding Indian tribes, the citizens of Franklin decided they were better off the way they were and set out to rejoin North Carolina.
The last legislature met in 1787, and by 1788, it was reacquired by North Carolina. Then, in 1790, it was made a part of the Southwest Territory and then became a part of the new state of Tennessee in 1796.
Even though Davy was born August 17, 1786, let's stick with Tennessee.
On August 23, 1999, New York City reported its first case of West Nile virus. Originally, they thought they were dealing with an outbreak of St. Louis encephalitis. There was a cluster of 8 cases, all involving the elderly, at the same time that large numbers of dead crows were showing up throughout the city.
The Center for Disease Control was called in, and they found it was indeed West Nile, which previously had only been found in Uganda and the Middle East. And it wasn't just crows that were affected. The virus is spread by mosquitoes and attacked robins, ducks, eagles, as well as horses and humans.
On August 23, 1904, a patent was issued to Harold Weed of Canastrota, New York, for his invention of tire chains to help driving in the snow. He got the idea from watching people wrap rope or vines around their tires in snowy weather.
His original design had the chains held in place simply from the inflation of the tire. That means when the snow came, you had to deflate your tire, put the chains on, and then reinflate. It was the air pressure that held them in place.
Did you know that Harold Weed got a boost for his invention when he talked Harry Houdini into doing an escape trick using his tire chains?
On this date in 1927, Sacco and Vanzetti were executed. On April 30th of 1920, a paymaster of a shoe company was shot and killed during a robbery in South Braintree, Massachusetts. The murderers were described as two Italian men. After going to a garage that police said was connected to the crime, Sacco and Vanzetti were arrested.
Although searches never turned up any of the money, and much of the evidence against the two was later discredited, the pair was convicted and sentenced to death. In 1925, Celestina Medeiros, then under a sentence for murder, confessed that it was he who had committed the crime. The Supreme Court refused to overturn the verdict, and the governor would not extend clemency. Sacco and Vanzetti were executed on August 23, 1927.
Did you know that on August 23, 1977, Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis declared Sacco and Vanzetti Memorial Day and issued a proclamation stating that they had been unjustly treated and that any disgrace should be forever removed from their names?
On this date in 1902, Fanny Farmer opened a cooking school in Boston. When she was in her early 30s, Miss Farmer attended the Boston Cooking School. The school promoted a scientific approach to food preparation, and it trained women to be cooking teachers at a time when employment opportunities were limited.
She graduated in 1898 and became the school's principal in 1891. In 1896, she published her first book, The Boston Cooking School Cookbook. This edition included a large number of straightforward recipes, as well as information on sanitation techniques, home management, and nutrition.
Did you know that the book was revolutionary and that it gave precise measurements for the recipes?
In 1902, she left the Boston School and opened her own, Miss Farmer's School of Cooking. Then in 1904, she wrote a book on food and cooking for the sick and convalescent.
In this book, she gave recommendations of foods for specific illnesses. It also contained a section on nutrition for children and on the digestive tract.
On August 23rd of 1989, Pete Rose got booted out of baseball. It seems as though gambling is an integral part of sports, and not just who will win, but by how much. That may generally be the case, but not for those within the sport. There, gambling is a definite no-no. But even that modern restriction was not always the case. John McGraw, manager of the New York Giants, publicly won $400 when his Giants won the World Series.
And it is reported that during halftime of the Army Notre Dame football game that Newt Rockne was criticizing his team for their lack of defense, and he questioned the apparent nonchalance of George Gipp when he asked, "Aren't you interested in this game?" Gipp was supposed to have taken a drag off a cigarette and answered, "Look, Rock, I got $400 bet on this game. I'm not about to blow it."
That kind of attitude drastically changed after the Black Sox scandal. Gambling by players was strictly forbidden, and so to Pete Rose. It had long been known that Pete liked to wager on football and horse racing, but allegations began to arise that he was also betting on baseball games, and he was betting on his own team.
At first, he denied the allegations, but investigations began to compile detailed information as to the truth. On August 23, 1989, he was banned for life from any participation in baseball. And, in spite of his many accomplishments as a player, he is also excluded from becoming a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Did you know that in 2004, he finally confessed that he had indeed bet on baseball games and on his own team, but he claimed only to have bet on his team if he thought they were going to win.
On this date in 1926, Rudolph Valentino died at the age of 31. The man was synonymous with the Sheik of Araby and had the reputation for being the great lover of the early silver screen. Upon the announcement of his death, many suicide attempts were reported.
Did you know that Valentino's first film appearance was as an extra in the film Alimony? And when he started getting parts, he was usually cast as a heavy or a gangster.
When the first American Women's College opened in the United States, did you know that it was Mount Holyoke Female Seminary in South Hadley, Massachusetts, that most people thought women needed refinement, not education? Well, that was about to change. In 1837, Mary Lyon founded the college, and on August 23, 1838, Mount Holyoke graduated their first class. Her words to her students were, "Go where no one else will go. Do what no one else will do."
I've got another motto for the school. For today's woman, men bend on their knees to women with degrees. Well, what do you think?
I think you can get up now, Bob.
And I think we need to go on to August 24th. In the year of 79 of the Common Era, Mount Vesuvius erupted in southern Italy, devastating the towns of Pompeii and Herculaneum. These were not isolated villages. They were thriving communities set at the bottom of the mountain close to the Bay of Naples.
Pompeii was a community of about 20,000. They were merchants, manufacturers, and farmers producing great orchards and vineyards from soil that had been enriched hundreds of years before from previous eruptions. The city also had gaming houses and brothels.
Herculaneum was a village of about 5,000 and was a favorite resort area for wealthy Romans because of its opulent villas and grand baths. At noon of the 24th, all this pleasure and prosperity came to an end.
The peak of Vesuvius exploded, and a 10-mile mushroom cloud of ash and pumice rose into the sky, and for the next 12 hours, debris rained down from the sky. In Pompeii, some 2,000 people hid in cellars, expecting to wait out the eruption. But the next morning, a cloud of toxic gas poured into the city, killing everybody who had chosen to remain. Then followed a flow of rock and mud that buried everything.
Meanwhile, over in Herculaneum, a great cloud of hot ash and gas came down the western slope of Vesuvius, either burning or asphyxiating the inhabitants of that city. Then followed the flow of mud and ash, which also buried that city.
Much of what we now know of this tragedy came from the historian Pliny the Younger, who was staying along the west bank of the bay when the explosion occurred. He stated that the eruption lasted for 18 hours, and the resultant flows of mud and ash buried Pompeii under 14 to 17 feet of debris, and Herculaneum was buried to a depth of 60 feet.
Today, Mount Vesuvius is the only active volcano on the European mainland. Its last eruption was in 1944, and its last major eruption occurred in 1631. If another explosion should occur, there are now over 700,000 people living in the area.
On August 24th of 1954, Congress passed the Communist Control Act. Even though Senator Joseph McCarthy had been discredited earlier in 1954, there were still lots of people who believed that there were communists everywhere trying to overthrow our government. Responding to that fear, this act was passed.
The act declared, "The Communist Party of the United States, though purportedly a political party, is in fact an instrumentality of a conspiracy to overthrow the government of the United States." So it was clear that the Communist Party should be outlawed.
And this act did it, right?
Well, maybe not. You see, 4 years earlier, Congress had passed the Internal Security Act, and these two bills did pretty much the same thing. Much of the language was even the same. It condemned communism and the Communist Party and set out penalties for anyone belonging to a group calling for the violent overthrow of the government.
So now we have two laws, both of them making it illegal to belong to the Communist Party.
Well, consider this. The 1964 Act made it clear that nothing in it should be construed as amending the Internal Securities Act.
Okay. So we have one law and a backup. Good enough.
Except that one of the provisions of the Internal Securities Act was that membership in the party alone was not sufficient cause for arrest or penalty. Actually, the 1964 Act said that the American Communist Party ought to be outlawed. It really didn't do it.
Well, made people feel good, though.
On this date in 1982, a Wall Street scheme is hatched, guaranteed to make somebody a lot of money.
Well, I'm ready. Fill me in.
Let's call it Martin Siegel meets Ivan Boesky. Siegel is an executive dealing in mergers and acquisitions, and Boesky is an arbitrator.
What's an arbitrator?
Someone who deals with buying and selling the same commodities at different prices in different markets.
Like, I buy something for $5 and then sell it to Para for $6?
Why would I do that?
I don't know. I guess because you know that I only pay $5 for it.
Close, but you're getting away from the story.
Okay. Boesky is an arbitrator.
And Siegel wants a consulting job. Boesky offers him one.
Further, Boesky tells Siegel that if he'll pass along information about upcoming mergers and acquisitions, there might be a big reward in it for him.
Oh, just a couple of friends doing each other favors.
Big favor. In January of 1983, although little information has passed between the two friends, suddenly $150,000 in $100 bills arise for Siegel. Now information really starts to flow.
Did you know that Boesky made $25 million by buying a lot of stock in Carnation Company just before its takeover?
The Securities and Exchange Commission noticed, and an investigation began. They also noticed that Siegel seemed to be involved in this and other Boesky deals. Still, business went on.
Well, a fellow does have to earn a little something to live on now, doesn't he?
And there is the cost of living to consider. So in 1985, Siegel demanded $400,000. But after he was paid, he began to have some doubts about the whole arrangement.
However, the regrets came too late. In 1986, it all came crashing down, and it wasn't just Siegel and Boesky that were on the hot seat. Some of the biggest traders in the market were affected. The entire incident came to symbolize the effects of unfettered greed on Wall Street in the mid-1980s.
On August 24th of 1572, the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre occurred in Paris. It was time of bitter feeling between Catholics and French Calvinists, called Huguenots. A tentative peace had been brokered, and to solidify it, King Charles IX of France arranged for his sister to marry the Huguenot leader, Henry Navarre, who later became King Henry IV.
That doesn't sound like such a good idea. A good Catholic girl marrying a Huguenot?
It seems that were many who shared that belief. And on August 22nd, an assassination attempt was made on one of the Huguenot leaders. The attempt failed, but the situation in Paris was tense, and King Charles agreed to investigate.
Enter now Catherine de' Medici, the king's mother. Some believed it was she who had ordered the first assassination attempt, and now she went to her son to try to convince him that the Huguenots were on the verge of rebellion and had to be stopped. A list was drawn up of who had to go, and on August 24th, the plan was put into action.
Mass slaughterers began in Paris and quickly spread to Rouen, Lyon, Bourget, Bordeaux, and Orleans. In spite of decree from the king to halt the killings, they continued on into October. An estimated 3,000 Protestants were killed in Paris, and as high as 70,000 throughout the rest of France.
On August 24th of 1821, the Treaty of Cordoba was signed, whereby Spain recognized the independence of Mexico. In the early 19th century, Napoleon's occupation of Spain led to outbreaks of violence all across Mexico. The reason? A push for Mexican independence. And on September 16th of 1810, a Catholic priest launched the Mexican War of Independence.
It was short-lived, and the priest was captured and hung. But the movement did not die, and other leaders arose, and the peasants followed. What they wanted was an end to Spanish rule, land reform, and racial equality between native-born Mexicans and the émigrés of Spanish descent.
When independence was finally achieved, it wasn't because of the peasants. Strangely, it was because of the royalists.
It happened like this. Liberals achieved power in Spain and promised the reforms that the Mexican revolutionaries were demanding. The royalists wanted no part of this. They backed independence from Mexico in order to preserve their privileged status.
Early in 1821, the royalists negotiated an agreement whereby Mexico would be established as a constitutional monarchy, the Roman Catholic Church would maintain its privileged position, and the Mexicans of Spanish descent would have the same elevated status as pure-blood Spaniards.
And Mexicans of mixed race and native Indian heritage?
Not so much. And this was the arrangement that was approved on August 24th.
On August 24th, 1981, John Lennon's killer was sentenced. Mark David Chapman was ordered to spend many, many years in prison.
On this day in 1814, the British began the burning of Washington, D.C.
And on August 24th, 1945, Cleveland pitcher Bob Feller returned from duty in the Navy and struck out 12 batters. Cleveland beat Detroit 4-2.
Which moves on to August 25th. In 1939, August 25th marked the opening of The Wizard of Oz in theaters across the country. It told the magical story of Dorothy Gale transported from Kansas to the wonderful world of Oz. She and her companions, a scarecrow and Tin Man, and the cowardly lion go on to Oz in search of brains, a heart, courage, and a way back home.
The film was a modest success when it was first released in 1939, but it has continued to grow in popularity and is now considered a classic. Come Oscar time, the picture lost out to Gone with the Wind, but did win an award for Best Song, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And Judy Garland won an award as Best Juvenile Actress.
Did you know that Judy Garland was 17 at the time she made that film? And did you know that the Oscar-winning song was almost deleted from the picture because someone thought that it slowed down the action?
On August 25th of 1835, the Great Moon Hoax began. A series of articles appearing in the New York Sun were meant to be a satire of the writings of one Reverend Thomas Dick, who claimed that there were some 23 trillion other inhabitants in our solar system, 4.2 billion of which were on the moon.
The Sun stories were reported to be as reprint of articles from the Edinburgh Journal of Science. They told of the observations of a noted researcher in astronomy, Dr. Andrew Gant, who had gone to South Africa to set up a new telescope there.
In actuality, there was no Dr. Gant, and the Journal of Science had ceased publication years before. Nevertheless, week after week, the paper related what Gant had seen through his telescope.
There were all kinds of fantastic animals, such as unicorns, two-legged beavers, and furry, winged humanoids who resembled bats. Gant also described the landscape replete with massive craters, enormous amethyst crystals, rushing rivers, and plush vegetation.
Most readers missed the satire and continued to buy more and more newspapers so as not to miss the next observations. Even a group of scientists came down from Yale to review the journal reports. They went back home, apparently never realizing that they had been had.
On September 16, 1835, the Sun printed a story explaining the hoax. Most people took it with a laugh and continued buying the Sun.
Well, I don't care if they did say it was a hoax. You know you can't trust science. Now, I learned as a child that there is a man in the moon and he lives on green cheese, and no scientist is going to tell me otherwise.
Has anyone besides you ever seen this man in the moon?
Certainly. His picture used to be on the old Procter & Gamble soapbox.
Oh, dear. On August 25th of 325, the Council of Nicaea ended. The need for the council arose when Arius, a Christian bishop from Alexandria, questioned the full divinity of Jesus. After all, he was born and had a beginning. What more do you need to make him a man?
What began as an academic dispute turned into a major theological division, so the emperor, Constantine, ordered the council to settle the issue. On August 25th, the council concluded that Arius was wrong, declared him a heretic, and so put away all future disagreements.
For a while, anyway. Seems I remember just a teensy disagreement in Paris beginning August 24th, 1572.
You got it. On this day in 1864, rebels attack on the second battle at Reims Station, Virginia. The railroad, which ran from Weldon, North Carolina, was a major supply route for the Confederate forces. For over 2 months, Lee's army had been under siege at Petersburg. Grant ordered his men to cut the line.
On August 18th, Grant had succeeded in interrupting the flow of goods, so Lee responded by stopping the trains further south and bringing the supplies in by wagon. Grant then ordered his troops to tear up the tracks. Lee moved quickly to stop this operation.
On August 25th, the Confederates attacked the Federals at Reims Station. The Northern forces lost 2,700 men, while the South lost just 700, and the supplies kept coming to Petersburg.
On August 25th, 1950, President Truman ordered the Army to seize control of the railroads. Troops had just been sent into Korea and America's economic and defense structure was dependent upon a smooth operating rail system. A strike had been threatened on August 18th, and Truman had ordered mediation.
When the mediation failed, Truman took the next step and nationalized the rail industry to become effective on the 27th at 4 p.m. Truman stated, "The government seizure of the railroads is imperative for the protection of American citizens as well as essential to the defense and security of the nation."
Did you know that it was basically the same justification that he used when some months later he nationalized the steel industry?
On this day in 1944, Paris is liberated. The city had fallen to the Nazis on June 14, 1940. 8 days later, the French signed an armistice, and a puppet state was established with its capital in Vichy.
In spite of the pact, the Free French under General Charles de Gaulle kept fighting, and resistance sprang up all over the country.
In late 1943, the French 2nd Armored formed in London. Its expressed purpose was to liberate Paris during the Allied invasion of France.
In August of 1944, the division arrived in Normandy, and by the 18th, the Allied forces were near Paris, and workers in the city went on strike as resistant fighters came out of hiding.
On the 23rd, Allied forces approached the city from the north and the south. On the 24th, they managed to cross the Seine, and just before dawn, they reached the heart of Paris.
German resistance melted during the night, and 20,000 troops surrendered or fled. Those who continued to fight were overcome.
On August 25, 1944, the 2nd Armored swept the western half of the city, and the 4th Infantry swept the eastern half. Paris was liberated.
And now our birthdays for the week. On August 20th, Benjamin Harrison in 1833.
On the 21st, Count Basie in 1904.
On the 22nd, actress Valerie Harper in 1938.
And on the 23rd, Oliver Hazard Perry in 1785.
On the 24th, Yasser Arafat in 1933.
And on the 25th, Ivan the Terrible in 1530.
Well, Bob, have you got a favorite date in August picked out yet?
Well, as a matter of fact.
Let me guess. It falls somewhere between the 9th and the 11th, and has to do with a lot of candles on a cake.
Gosh, Para, you must be psychic. But to be fair, there are still 6 days remaining, so let's look at them before I voice my selection.
Good answer, but remember, Kurt and I get to vote also.
Oh, you wouldn't vote against me, would you? Really? Would you?
This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and thank you for listening to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Para Tolleson. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
We would like to thank WRAL.com, a part of the Raleigh-based Capital Broadcasting Company's new media group, for the continued support.
And if any of you could help underwrite our programming, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.
And be back next week to see what day in August we pick to be represented as the August holiday. Until next week,
goodbye.